Welcome, great patriotic Americans, to October 29th on Joe's Daily U.S. History Lesson. I am your host, Joseph DeCristoforo. And one of the reasons why I do this show is because Americans, unlike just about everybody else in the world, fly our flag everywhere you look. It's the patriotism you see. I assembled this podcast from a tool shed in my backyard in La Mesa, California, right next to America's finest city, San Diego. If you're looking to move to the area, or if you have any questions about real estate, check out TeresaLovesRealEstate.com. Because as a full-service Encinitas and San Diego real estate professional, Teresa works with buyers, sellers, and investors in real estate transactions. So yeah, check it out, TeresaLovesRealEstate.com. And now let's begin the show as we normally do with the Pledge of Allegiance. Let's everybody stand up, face the flag if we have one, and put our right hands over our hearts, and begin. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Booyah, America! And now on to today's headlines. Anton LaVey, the creator of the Church of Satan, dies ironically at St. Mary's Medical Center. Plus, William Clark of Lewis and Clark records one of the first fire shelters ever. Major Benjamin Talmadge replaces General Scott in George Washington's spy ring. And the champion KOs Big George in the Rumble in the Jungle. All right, so now let's get started. 1997, Anton LaVey, creator of the Church of Satan, dies ironically at St. Mary's Medical Center, 13 days after the full moon. I'm not sure if he did that to mess with us or not. These American horror stories just seem to fall right into my lap somehow. When he was born, his name was Howard. So at least he was smart enough to sell his church by changing his name from Howard to Anton. Not much is really known about this fella, even though he's written 5 books, starting with the Satanic Bible, since he lied about much of his life, like sleeping with Marilyn Monroe, which was very gutsy considering her husband Joe DiMaggio didn't whack his baseball bat across his head. He also lied about being friends with former President Chester Arthur's grandson, and writing part of Roman Polanski's Rosemary's Baby, which incidentally came out the same year LaVey started his church. We do know that as a teenager, he went to a high school in Mill Valley, in the San Francisco Bay Area, which is where Jerry Garcia of the Grateful Dead used to live. I know this because I saw him one time at the store when I was with my friends one day in Mill Valley in 1990. Anyway, we also know that LaVey was very proficient in playing the organ, on which he played really creepy music. What we don't know for sure is just about everything else. Supposedly, he left high school at age 16 to join a circus, but the only circus he probably ever worked at was his so-called church. LaVey's message was one of a hybrid belief that gaps religion and psychology. Religion was hypocritical, oppressing the very needs of the elements of life itself, which is why on Sunday mornings, the same people who were on their knees praying were the same people who went to strip clubs on Friday nights. In other words, the Church of Satan wasn't weird like the other factions that were splintering off of his church, the ones that were practicing human and goat sacrifices, which supposedly never happened in the Church of Satan. LaVey was married several times and raised 3 children. 2 girls, Carla Maritza, Zena Galatea, and a son, Satan Xerxes, his oldest. He baptized Zena in his church and detailed it in one of his books, Satanic Rituals. Zena kind of looks like she could pass off as the keyboardist from Cradle of Filth, and I'm not sure if Lindsay Schoolcraft would consider that a compliment or an insult, and I have a feeling a lot of my listeners don't actually listen to Cradle of Filth like I do. Yeah. Zena these days has denounced her father's church and religion. But getting back to Satanic Rituals, it was inspired by the Illuminati, the Knights Templar, and the Freemasons. He would read these rituals over music beds on his album Satan's Mass. For the music bed, he used Beethoven and Wagner, who I'm sure didn't receive any royalties. Whether it was God or Satan that let Anton die on this night in 1997 at St. Mary's in San Fran remains to be debated. And I can't help but wondering if it's even brought up on Carla's weekly radio show on Satanism. It would appear that Anton would like to rest in peace instead of hell after all. Happy Halloween, everybody! 1804. William Clark notes the first recorded fire shelter. A fire shelter, bit like a pup tent, these days is made out of aluminum, silicone, and fiberglass, and is used as a last resort with firefighters. When deployed, a fire shelter deflects convective heat and can protect a firefighter, as well as helping him or her breathe oxygen for up to an hour. And it was William Clark, actually, who seen one of these in his journeys with Meriwether Lewis during a prairie wildfire near Fort Mandan in North Dakota. Clark noted that he saw a Native American mom throw what he called a green buffalo skin over her son to protect him from the flames. 1778. Talmadge replaces General Scott in Washington's spy ring. The Culper spy ring, a network of spies and enemy lines, fed critical information to General George Washington during the American Revolution, which allowed him to gain the upper hand in critical points of the war, including Trenton, Yorktown, West Point, and much more. Benjamin Talmadge led the ring and passed information from Caleb Brewster to Washington. Brewster would get his information from Abraham Woodhull, who watched troop movements and other essential details very closely on Long Island. But the real important information came from Robert Townsend in New York City. Austin Rowe would deliver goods to the spy network. But in the beginning, the information of the Culper spy ring was rocky. Nathan Hale had already been caught and executed by the British in New York, and Washington vowed to not let that happen again. Unfortunately, under the command of Brigadier General Charles Scott, it would. Talmadge and Scott had different methods of dealing with spies. Talmadge preferred the communication amongst a reliable network of spies working together. Scott's method of dispatching spies was to put five of them in Long Island, each on their own separate missions, without any knowledge of the other. So, in addition to the security of the overall mission, should one be captured, the Redcoats wouldn't be able to compare the different stories for accuracy. But Scott wasn't counting on losing more than one of his spies. And in fact, he lost three of them. War is hell, folks, and battles demand sacrifice. But Washington wasn't willing to sacrifice any more innocent lives than he had to. All of a sudden, Talmadge's plan started to look pretty good. And it would be on this day in 1778, Scott resigned as chief of intelligence, and Talmadge took his place. As far as Charles Scott went, after a brief furlough, he would continue to fight in the Southern Theater with Benjamin Lincoln. During Henry Clinton's siege of Charleston, Scott would be captured and released in 1781. After the Revolution, Scott moved to Kentucky, where he would lead militia into raids against the American Indians. And then he would become governor of Kentucky. 1974. The champion takes down Big George in the Rumble in the Jungle. Quite possibly one of the greatest knockout punches ever recorded, and one of the greatest sporting events that went down in the 20th century, also a big upset. Big George Foreman, 6'3" and 220 pounds from Houston, Texas, had 40 wins and 0 losses coming into this fight, 37 of them KOs. Muhammad Ali, the greatest, the champion, the Louisville Slugger, also 6'3", 4 pounds lighter than Big George. As far as that nice, shiny championship belt around Big George's waist, that used to belong to Ali's, and now he wanted it back, and would need a strategy against Foreman's superior strength, using it against him. Big George had a tough-to-beat strategy that involves holding out his arms, goading his opponent inwards, then knocking them off balance by pulling their arms down and throwing his punch. But the greatest was on to the strategy, and when the first bell rang, so was his plan. As Foreman would reach out, Ali would go in for the quick punch of the head. With Ali, Foreman wouldn't be able to just pull his arms down because Ali saw that coming and yanked his arms away, letting loose another punch of the face. Foreman also had a proven strategy of punching his opponents in the shoulder to knock them off balance as he delivered a bigger blow. But that wouldn't work against Ali, since Ali was a master at dodging these punches, again leaving Foreman wide open for the counter. Foreman would get Ali into the corner, and Ali would absorb the punches with his forearms, wearing down Big George. By round 8, Ding, ding. It was clear Foreman was exhausted. Then, Ollie landed a few more, and then connected with an angled whipping hook, and then a cross, and Big George went down like that. The champion became the champion once again in one of the greatest bouts between two of the most skilled fighters in American history. And so that is all, my friends, for October 29th on Joe's Daily U.S. History Lesson. Once again, I'm your host, Joseph DeCristoforo. Check out the website, joesdailyushistorylesson.com. Let me know what you thought about today's ep. Or what about some of the other stuff that's on the website that I didn't talk about today? Such as, is it possible to talk about the stock market crash without getting into a huge economic debate? We can try, but it's okay if we do, as long as we stay to the point. Or what about that story on Duane Allman? Tied to the Whipping Post is not just my favorite Allman Brothers song, it's one of my favorite songs ever. What's yours? So yeah, let me know what you think on the comment board. You can also check out some of the multiple choice quizzes while you're on there. Good luck with those. And be sure to check out tomorrow's ep. We'll wish a happy birthday to John Adams. Plus, since it is that time of year, the War of the Worlds broadcasts. So don't miss that. In the meantime, you can catch me on Facebook and Twitter. My Twitter handle is @JDUSHL. So thanks for listening, everyone, and thanks for being great patriotic Americans. We'll see you tomorrow.